Hi, everyone, to another weekly edition of Story Structure and Story Analysis from a Dramatica Point of View. Hope you had a great week of writing, and we'll see you next time. That's the end. He was the most human. Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Narrative First Podcast, the weekly podcast where story is always king. I am your host, Jim Hull, the voice of Narrative First, and this is episode number 39, the final word on generating dramatic tension in your story. Hi, everyone. Another weekly edition of Story Structure and Story Analysis from a Dramatica Point of View. This week, we have two special guests on the podcast. One is Melanie Ann Phillips, the co-creator of the Dramatic Theory of Story, and the second is Brian Davis, who is a Dramatica mentorship client and a recent graduate of LMU's screenwriting program, who has a word or two to say about the process of working with Dramatica and other writers who don't know Dramatica, which I thought would be interesting for everybody to hear. A little bit of follow-up from last week. Last week's podcast, which actually was probably 2 weeks ago, was the introductory podcast, finished part two of that, and got that out and put all the links there. That would be episodes 37 and 38, which are the introduction to Dramatica and the genesis of Narrative First, which is great. If you have anybody that you know that is interested in Dramatica or is just starting out and would like to have, you know, kind of an introduction to it and would like some kind of place to go that isn't the theory book, because sometimes the theory book that's online can be a bit confusing. And if you're not aware, the entire theory book, I think it's like 350 pages when there used to be pages. It's all free online at dramatica.com/theory/book, and you can get the whole thing there. But as I said, it can be confusing. A lot of people get confused about the difference between story forming and storytelling, story encoding, story weaving. And so a lot of the articles and blog posts and analysis that you find on Narrative First are there to hopefully make it easier for you to understand the theory and get you started so that you can improve the quality of your storytelling. So if you or anyone else you know you think would be interested in this introductory podcast, point them to narrativefirst.com/podcasts/37 for the first one and /38 for the second one. Also last week, and I believe I mentioned it in the podcast, two podcasts ago, I managed to get the blog post up on the thinking of the main character as a perspective and not simply just a character. You know, when you think about stuff like the hero or the protagonist or anything like that, both those are present within a story, but the Dramatica point of view, or what is important from the Dramatica perspective of things, is looking at the main character as a perspective, as a point of view on a particular way to solve a problem, not actually a person, not like a real character. Sometimes you'll read in screenwriting books and storybooks how you have to make a three-dimensional character and how you have to round it out and make it, you know, as real as possible. And the real part is giving them a point of view, a particular way to solving problems that doesn't quite match up with somebody else's point of view. And if you think of that perspective as being the all-important thing, kind of the same way when we talk about the influence character and how that gets handed off from character to character, that you can also have a handoff main character, which is really rare, or you can have a collective main character, like there was in Stalag 17, which we went over in the user group meeting last fall. You know, it was the entire group in the barracks there that was the main character, because they were unaware of what was really going on there. And because they all share the same perspective, they all share the same doubt or paranoia surrounding, you know, who's really working with the Germans. So the important thing, especially when you're coming to Dramatica and you're trying to figure out your main character, if you can think of it more less as an actual person and more as a point of view that you as an author are trying to explore, you know, something that you find interesting. You know, the argument of the story is the story form itself. And so it's not really, the argument isn't what the main character is talking about or what he or she is arguing with the influence character. The main character is a particular point of view towards solving problems that you're arguing either for or against, and you prove it by showing, you know, whether or not it turned out success or failure, or good or bad. In my head, I'm remembering a conversation with Melanie last week where she says she actually listens to the podcast and she likes it, which makes me completely nervous because now that I know, I figured she wouldn't waste her time listening to it. Now that I know she's listening to it, I get even more nervous. And so if you hear me stutter or kind of go offline, that's just because somebody I look up to actually listens and finds something in it. So yeah, I've completely lost track of what I was talking about. Oh yes, main characters and perspective. Yeah, so if you can separate yourself from this idea that the main character is an actual person and get into the frame of mind that actually all the through lines are just perspectives, and that's why they don't even ever have to meet. It would be a very strange experience, but if you were able to just get across the I perspective of a way to solve a problem and the you perspective of a way to solve a problem, and then the we perspective, how we solve problems, and then the they perspective, if you just put those four perspectives together, the audience will be able to see, put together, what kind of argument you're trying to make. And the reason for that is because we all have narrative machines inside our head, or actually, which I was learning last week, it's more about that whole thing about how the observer changes what is observed, and so that's basically what narrative is. So we're just ascribing narrative to subject matter, or no, the idea was that the narrative moves through the subject matter and colors it or changes it based on that perspective. So there really is no real right answer to anything, or no one right answer. It all depends on context, and the way you set up context is to make sure you have those perspectives set up. So the perspective of the main character, there's a particular context there, and there's a particular context of the influence character, and so on. In the Discuss Dramatica forums, I mentioned, kind of going along the same way to someone else, how they had a question about change or steadfast and what that meant. And it was more, I was trying to get them to get across what the issue of the main character was, not so much the main character issue as a story point, but what kind of problems or perspective, what was of most concern to them, what context were they coming from? Because only then can you decide, well, okay, well, did that context change for them, or did it remain steadfast? That's the key important part. Which to me is the really cool part about Dramatica, which makes it so much far more interesting than anything else in the entire universe, is because it just has this other layer to it, this other understanding of conflict and people's problems and, you know, what they go through day in and day out, and you just use narrative to give a framework for understanding how to change the way you go about doing things. So if you would like, make sure you go check that out. That was last week's blog post, and I'm starting up again now that I'm super situated, everything's all groovy and we're back in the swing of things, trying to do at least one post a day. At least. I love keeping up that schedule, just things I find. A lot of it lately is just me republishing stuff that Melanie puts out, just because anything she says is great. Once there's something new, you gotta refer to it over and over again. Anything like that, I'll just keep posting stuff and just keep everybody up to date on what you should be watching, what you should be reading, what you should be knowing about story. You know, basically the latest in story structure and story analysis. Speaking of analysis, I had the, I guess, pleasure of watching BFG over the weekend. Which was a really strange experience, because on the one hand, I was an animator for 20 years, 5 years at Disney, 15 years at DreamWorks, and so I'm very familiar with what makes good animation and what makes bad animation, character animation in particular. And I thought the character animation in BFG was astounding. I understand a lot of its motion capture. I get it. I know how it works. But just the quality of it and just the lushness of the character performances and the animation itself, I thought was astounding, which was challenging because as much as I wanted to continue to watch it, I found myself completely bored to tears with the actual story, because essentially there really isn't a story. I mean, it's there's just nothing there that you can actually call what Dramatica would refer to as a complete story. Strangely enough, it actually is a piece of work that has absolutely no overall story through line. So it has a bit. There are elements of main character and influence character, and obviously there's a relationship which they keep playing up in the marketing of it. And I realize this movie's like 2 years old, but you know, I see things when I see things. It's strange. It's a really strange experience because there's no overall story through line. And I've heard Chris mention that the novel of Twilight, I guess he actually took the time to read the first novel in the Twilight series. He said it's the same thing. Like, there's no overall story through line in that. And it's just maddening because there's no greater context to things. And particularly for male/linear readers, it's like, well, what's the purpose of all this? And that's the same experience I had watching BFG. It's like, well, what's the purpose of this? And eventually it just becomes, well, is the bad guy going to beat up the little kid or eat the little kid? And the way it's resolved is really like just kind of light and frothy. And you know, it's difficult because it's on the one hand, it's great animation directed by Steven Spielberg. And then you have John Williams music, and there's written by the same person who wrote E.T., so you're like, oh, this is going to be amazing. But there's a reason why when it came out, you didn't really hear much about it. And that's because there just really wasn't anything to it, because that lack of the overall story through line. If you haven't had a chance to listen to our analysis of E.T. in the user group meeting that we did in January, make sure you check that out. Because for the longest time, obviously I loved the film. I will confess that it was the first movie that actually made me cry. It was either that or Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan. They both came out around the same time, I think, and I forget. I have memories in the Man Theater in Valencia somehow crying, I think, when Spock died. He was the most human. Something to that effect. Chokes me up just thinking about it. So my hopes in seeing BFG was that, oh, hopefully this could be the same thing. You know, the reason why E.T. is so beloved and people have seen it over and over again and everybody loves the actual story of it is because of the complete story that's in there and how both Elliot and E.T. share abandonment issues. You know, one is in the head, is dealing with it internally, and the other one's was actually abandoned on a planet, and so he's dealing with it externally, and how they come together. It's beautiful. And unfortunately, BFG didn't have the same thing. So, I mean, if you want to see an intense 2-hour demo reel of some really great animation, then for sure, check it out. You know, just have it running in the background. But if you're trying to come at it from a Dramatica point of view, you're going to be bored. Sorry. The reason why, again, is those four perspectives that I was talking about previously with the main character as a perspective. The reason why people love stories so much and the reason they keep coming back to them over and over and over again is because a story gives you both gives you all four at once. Like, in the real world, you can't take all four perspectives at once. And I put up my slide from way back when that kind of explains this, where, you know, if you take the I perspective, you can also take the you and the we, but you can't look at I from a they perspective, you know, simultaneously. You just physically can't do that. And then if you take the they perspective, you can take the they, the you, and the we, but you can't take the I because you can't be in their shoes, that kind of experience. So the great thing about a story is that it actually gives you a chance to see all four within the same body of work. So you can actually get meaning, so you can understand what's really going on. So when you leave a through line out, then it just becomes like real life. And it's like, well, why should I waste time listening to this story when I can get this in my real life? And so narratives are something special, and they're special because of those four perspectives. Also this week, I just put up today a podcast. I put up a blog post on the inciting incident. Somebody, a new client, was asking me about it. And it was interesting to me because, you know, what he considers to be the inciting incident is also what most people assume is the quote-unquote call to adventure within the hero's journey. You know, the difference between is that what Dramatic is looking for with the inciting incident? And everybody's so used to blending all those four perspectives that, you know, the idea that you have different drivers for different through lines and that that's the more important part, not some nebulous thing called the inciting incident, can be a bit challenging at first to understand. So I put up a quick blog post about how that all works together. And it was funny because I linked to the hero's journey, the guy who loves it more than anything. And he called 3, 4, or 5-act structures infantile, which I thought was really hurtful because I know 3 and 4-act structures. I don't know a 5-act structure, but I don't think they're infantile. And yes, the complex hero's journey, I would say complicated hero's journey, but so anyways. But he didn't like the inciting incident either. That was my whole reason for putting it up there anyways. And then when I was pasting it in, I was like, hey, that's not very nice. He called the 3-act and 4-act structure infantile. Why is that infantile? It's just funny because I do the same thing, but I do it about like Aristotle and stuff like that. Anyways, so yes. So the inciting incident, what most people call the call to adventure. So from the Dramatica point of view, that's when the main character and overall story through lines connect, like when they first weave together. So it's not really when the story starts, because you could have the main character through line start way back when. You could have the overall story through line start way back when. They don't start at the exact same moment, those perspectives. So more importantly, when it comes to like constructing a story or trying to find out where the actual conflict is coming from, you want to find the initial story driver of the overall story. And of course, I use the easy example of the original Star Wars movie, where the inciting incident, everybody universally agrees, it's when Luke gets the message from R2-D2, help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're my only hope. And that's like the call to adventure, dun-dun-dun. Because he has to go on a mythical journey to reassociate himself with his core being or whatever it is. Anyways, so that's the call to adventure. So from Dramatica's point of view, that's just where the main character and overall story through line connect, which is really just kind of not important at all because they're going to connect somewhere. So where they connect, it's like, well, they connect here or there. It's really not essential. They can connect wherever. It's not important. And in Dramatica, order is important, and when things happen are important. So if an actual, when they happen isn't important, then it's not important to the actual story form, to the meaning of the story. So the actual story driver, what actually starts the story of Star Wars, is when Darth, takes the ballsy move of boarding Princess Leia's ship, and then it's like, whoa, okay, because previously they had kind of like a little Cold War thing between the two of them, where it's like, all right, well, we don't like each other, but, you know, there's kind of this, like, balance of hatred. But now that you came aboard our ship, it's like, that's really, you can't do that kind of thing. And now we've got to just, like, find some way to fight against them. And that actually starts the overall story. And then because I can't just use Star Wars over and over again for the same examples and use it over and over and over again, I threw Manchester by the Sea in there. Because hopefully Mr. Davis, who he'll be coming up here on the podcast, will have his Dramatica story expert analysis of Manchester by the Sea, which he's gone through and hit every single story point, which is fantastic. And that one too, the overall story and main character story through lines are offset. And these quote unquote call to adventure, which when his brother dies or when he finds out that he's supposed to take care of Patrick or whatever that inciting incident, when you would refer to it as, you know, a lot of people think that's when the story starts, is when his brother dies, because they're thinking inciting incident, when does the main character and overall story through line start. And that's not really what happens. What happens is in the overall story through line, it starts when his brother Joe gets that diagnosis that, hey, you only got 10 years to live. And then that sets everything off, because now there's like, okay, now I got to start planning. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? And then actually his death is the quote-unquote first act turn, or the second story driver, you know. And obviously the main character has issues that start prior to his brother's death. So that happens within the first act. But they come together, that inciting incident to Forsake. That's why it doesn't mean anything. The story doesn't start then. The story, the actual inequity in the story, you know, with a dying man's wishes that drives the entire story, starts with that initial diagnosis. And that's important. It's not just backstory. It's actually an essential part of the meaning of the story. When the final analysis comes out for Manchester, you're going to love it. It'll be up by next week. And hopefully if it gets approved, I mean, it'll get approved, but if it gets approved enough time, we'll have it up and be able to link to it. And so that you'll be able to check it out. But yes, there is a difference between the inciting incident and what Dramatic considers the first story driver. And then also, the inciting incident it's like the MacGuffin. It's like a silly old way, I guess you could say infantile way, of looking at story that probably should end. So our first guest is Brian Davis, who, once again, he's been a Dramatica mentorship client for about a year now, and has shown a remarkable, just a huge change in understanding of story. I mean, he already gets story really, really well, has an innate story sense, but being able to take everything he knew prior to that and what he learned at LMU and be able to put that into, or see things through a new light, through the Dramatica filter, has been really eye-opening, not just for me, but also for him. And he was telling me on the phone about this experience he had in the notes sessions. You know, so part of the screenwriting program at LMU is, you know, you write a screenplay. That makes sense. And then you come in and the teacher sits down with the students and everybody evaluates and give notes, you know, basically like a notes session that you would get at any kind of story meeting. And he said there was a marked difference between his experience and his fellow colleagues' experience, because a lot of what happens in the notes session, you know, can send you off on a different path. You know, you have a certain idea of what it is you want to say with your story and what you want to do, and then somebody will throw out other ideas, and then that sounds great, and then so then you start riffing on that. And if you don't have like a set purpose or an intent, something that you're trying to get across, and an actual like, and have that tied to some kind of thematic structure, you can get thrown off into all kinds of different directions, which is the problem, you know, which would happen with a lot of the animated films I worked on when they didn't really have a set purpose. They just had a cool concept. And then, you know, if there is no singular story mind, what Dramatica would call a story mind, and not just one person, but the work itself having a purpose or an intent, it can just go off in all directions. And then, you know, you spend the last 9 months trying to fix everything and make it all work, and then everybody gets burnt out and tons of overtime, and it's a nightmare. The difference from the Dramatica point of view, when you have that actual story form, you know what it is you're trying to say, is that you can make sure that all the notes that come in, you can filter it through that and pick and choose what you want, and be able to steer those ideas, keep them on track with what your original author's intent was. So I'll let Brian explain here.
So you were saying it was much easier, or you felt like you had an easier time with the rewrite process compared to other students, and that's because you had the story form to go off of.
Yeah.
Okay. Was that a question? That's called a leading question, and then you kind of elaborate on it. Oh, Jesus.
I guess the big takeaway for me in going through this rewrite process was realizing the importance of getting the story form locked down in the beginning. Because every time that I had a problem that came up with my storytelling, I had to figure out how to solve it instead of going and changing the story form. So,
which is what all your other... Which is what you were, your other... fellow students were doing, right?
Yeah, and so because of that, like, they never really know if they're improving or not because they're just opening up a whole new set of problems. And then oftentimes they'll get multiple story forms going at the same time. I think one girl in class had like three narratives going at once.
Okay.
And
so you're saying it was hard for her to focus on completing one narrative instead of having three unfinished narratives.
Yeah, and it wasn't like there was like subplots. It wasn't like there was, you know, three different subplot narratives woven together. It was like the single story that she was trying to tell had three simultaneous narratives, all of which were incomplete. And so she was frustrated because, you know, she could never really figure out if she was improving, and she had, you know, and she ended up having more complications and more problems to deal with. Because she was just chasing her tail. Whereas whenever a problem came up for me, like, we had to actually, like, figure out how to solve it with the narrative that I had chosen in order to keep moving forward.
And you felt like it was more about actual problem solving. And you were telling me that it was something cool about how it's a lot like how Dramatica works, the difference between problem solving and justification.
Yeah, so with Dramatica, you know, the theory is based on a single human mind trying to solve a problem, and there are characters that change and characters that remain steadfast. And so when a character's changing, in their backstory, they've built up a bunch of justifications for why they do what they do. And they can either, you know, lose those justifications and change their point of view, or they could maintain them, or, you know, someone else could, you know, build up more justification. So, like, story forming is the process of, you know, building up justification for a writer, because you're just endlessly coming up with new stories that you can tell yourself or tell other people. Whereas if you actually, as a writer, want to tell a really clear story that someone else is going to understand, you have to go through and solve all the problems that are going to come up around that until you have a very clear story. One of the problems with being in a writer's room is that you're constantly getting all of this feedback, and a lot of times your story gets hijacked, and you can have multiple narratives going on at the same time, or you just get all of these story ideas that lead you down to telling stories that you may or may not want to tell, and half the time it doesn't solve your problems, half the time it just gives you a bunch more problems to solve, and you could spend your whole life writing and rewriting and addressing all of that feedback and still never clearly tell a story. So all of my classmates ended up rewriting their stories to be different stories entirely, even though the content didn't change very much. Whereas with me, the content changed a lot, but both stories are the exact same story form. It's just that this version is a much better version and a more clear presentation of the story form. So I never want to go through the process of having to endlessly, you know, generate story material that's not grounded in anything and not know if I'm improving, because it's really tough to spend all that time, effort, resources, energy.
Thank you, Brian. I've always noticed that, like, when I'm in writing rooms, and having that story form makes it easier to keep everybody on track. So it's great when somebody else that goes through it actually has the same kind of experience.
So yes, so I mean that. I mean it's great. So if you're interested in learning this, obviously the Dramatica Mentorship Program is a great way to be able to learn it yourself and apply it to your own work. But just having that buddy on the side there, that like it used to be the ultimate creative writing partner was how Dramatica was built, which is great because, you know, that partner is there to keep you honest and keep you on track with what your original intent is. And having those notes there, you know, just increases and exponentially elevates the quality of your storytelling. Secondly, we have Melanie Ann Phillips on the podcast this week. And last week, I met with Melanie, and we sat down and discussed all things Dramatica, which is a great, amazing experience. And she said I could actually share some of this with you because she's starting to see all her work through Dramatica in kind of a different light. And the one thing that she had started the whole story mind with, and where, you know, the Eureka moment, was this idea that one side divides and the other side multiplies. And it's kind of the basis for pretty much everything in Dramatica, like the way all the different plot progressions work, how the different elements work together, you know, how every quad is built, is all based on this idea that one side divides and the other side multiplies. Well, now she has this idea that it's much more eloquent than that, and it's more about the difference between one side blending and the other side looking at things as discrete or separate. And what she does now when she teaches it is she actually starts with the you and I video. You know, you and I are both alike. No, we're nothing alike, that montage, which I'll leave a link to in the show notes. And she uses that as the basis for everything that comes after. It's like, once you understand that part, then everything else that comes after in Dramatica will make sense. So I'll let Melanie explain.
So I have like tons of questions. So you, the first one is, you said you had a whole new way of teaching everybody.
Well, yeah.
Which I think is, this is the kind of the backwards way, sort of?
No, sort of, kind of. It's backwards if you're going after structure. It's frontwards if you're going after...
From my point of view, it's backwards.
From your point of view, it's backwards. Okay. I just did a... I was invited, to my great surprise and honor and privilege, to present a one-day seminar for pay to the Directors Guild of Canada.
That's always nice. So they just contacted you out of the blue?
Somebody who'd followed me for years was putting together a series of classes, which I hadn't done before, as an expansion program, so directors could learn more about stories so they could get their own things created, because right now they're pretty much just doing shop services for American productions. And that's what it means to be a Canadian filmmaker. So they wanted to encourage people to do their own stuff. So they started a program, which has been very successful since I delivered my thing, to get people to learn about stories so they could put their own projects together and maybe get them funded and start a renaissance in the Canadian film industry. And so this was it's divided into two parts, like the Writers Guild East and West. This is the West Coast version of the Directors Guild of Canada.
Okay.
And I wanted to bring them something based on some ideas I'd been working with about how to take an audience that knows nothing about structure or Dramatica and do the equivalent of what I just talked about with this having a structural form attached to subject matter. If you find the right form, you can pull people in. So I figured that the reverse must also be true, that if you have an accepted subject matter, then if it's connected to a structure, they'll pull the structure in, even if they'd normally be resistant to it.
Okay.
If you have a subject matter that is compelling, friendly, open, accepted, that would pass through the psychological filter.
Yes, please, thank you.
So, this little thing that the guy from USC was doing with the story points that were led to more box office, if used in reverse, then you say psychologically there's also a filter for subject matter, and if you can find subject matter that's acceptable, then you can associate any structure with it as long as they're not biased against the structure. So that's the key. You have to make sure they're not biased against either one, really. It's like an old dumbbell when you're trying to exercise with two big balls. One of them is the structure, one's the storytelling, they're connected by the bar in the middle. If either one of them is a reject because it's bad, then it takes the other one with it and rejects it because they're connected.
Okay.
If both of them are not associated with something negative, they will be quickly considered. If either one of them is a positive thing and the other is not known, it will accept the unknown one along with the positive one, and that's like propaganda, it'll go right into you. And if both of them are positive things, it'll be swallowed whole.
Okay.
Okay. So, to teach structure, the old way, of course, is to talk about story minds, to talk about main and influence characters, to talk about...
all the exciting stuff.
Yeah, all the hard structural stuff that, in and of itself, bears no direct connection to subject matter.
Okay.
And therefore is an intellectual pursuit, which is not what inspires the muse.
Okay.
So, nice Reuben sandwich here. We'll teach for food. Anyway. So the thing is, I thought, what to me is the most important thing in the structure? If I could only give them one item and nothing else, what would it be? Because that's where I have to start. And if I don't want to have to prep them intellectually, I don't want to have to give them anything in advance to try to understand before they connect to it emotionally, how the hell could I do that?
Right.
So I was working on this PowerPoint. We, of course, have the famous video, you and I are both alive, most everybody has seen. I've got one on my website, I have a direct link to it, you know, since they keep taking it off of YouTube.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, I thought, what if I told them that lots of people had taken attempts at structure, there was, you know, Young and Campbell and Fogler and all this stuff, and then, you know, we came up with our thing that we first released in 1994, and it was a whole new view of story that solved all the problems, and then a big explosion of fireworks goes off and says, ta-da, and then sinks, and I say, well, maybe not so much, it's just, you know, it's a new theory, it's another way of looking at things. But rather than trying to talk about that, let's take a look at something. Just like you have a teaser of motion pictures, I said to these directors, we got practically a full house, it was very gratifying. Since then, the reports have come back. They asked me to come back and do another one of these things in 2018 because they had such positive feedback from their members. Tooting on horn here. They liked it. So that one was about Bildis, how to find and fix problems in your narrative for motion pictures and television. This one is billed as how to create narratives for your motion pictures and television. That's going to be the next one.
Okay.
So I thought if I take this, you and I are both alive. And I ran that video clip as the first introduction to what we're going to be talking about. They would intuitively get this relationship without having been taught anything by me. So I put that up there and ran it. I ran a 7.5 minute version. And at the end of it, and during it, people are laughing, they're catching on to what's going on. And I went from there to say, what's happening here? That was my slide. What's happening here? And I said, narrative is happening here. Narrative is happening. And when you look at it, it's not always between the protagonist and antagonist. You know, those guys, these aren't always in these clips, protagonist and antagonist. You can see that this one isn't, that one isn't. So something else is going on that isn't directly, absolutely associated with protagonist and antagonist. What is this thing? Well, it's this relationship between these two characters, and here's what it's about, and here's why it's important, and you can use this technique. It's never seen as a cliche by a reader or an audience because they want it so much that they expect to see almost that scene of you and I are both alike. And if it's not there, in some form that they can recognize, they're going to feel that you haven't dealt with the head and the heart of the story and how they see things, the headline, the heartline. That's the heartline. The whole heartline is built around name and influence. That's where all the passion comes from. That's where the core of the message comes from. That's where all the passionate connection with the story comes from, the name and the influence. Buy me a sandwich here. Good Reuben. Anyway, so the headline, everybody knows that, the plot, what's going on, the overall story, protagonist, antagonist, all the archetypes and all that stuff. But you know, that's only 1/4 of what the story structure is, the story form is. It all takes place in the overall story. Everything else, the other 3/4. Why? Because we're dealing with a map of the mind, and really, the overall story is how the mind sees what's going on in the outside world. It's really all taking place. It's all in your head, as George Harrison said. So only 1/4 of it is actually dealing with the objective reality. The rest is all subjective, passionate, heart-driven. So when when the main character and the influenced character get together, that forms the core of the entire passionate experience of the story at a structural level. Now, having told them that, I could say, do you have these two characters in your story?
Right.
Do you have a moment like that where you are identified so that the audience, in this case, because it's motion pictures and television, so the audience is absolutely sure who those characters are and what that difference is between them. And if you don't have those characters and you don't have that moment,
yeah.
Thank you. If you don't have those characters
and you don't have that moment, then you've got a hole in your story. You've got a hole in your heart of your story. And that hole in the heart of your story is fatal. If you don't have that relationship, your story is just a series of events.
Right.
Okay? So now, go back in your mind, look at your story that you're thinking about, or several stories you have, and see if you've got those two characters, whether they're the protagonist, antagonist, or two other Joes, you know, Joe and Sally. And see if you have that moment. And that's the first thing we're going to fix, is if you don't have it, get it, put it in, do it, make sure it's there. And then we went on from there to talk a little bit more about that relationship between the two and how they saw things, you know, why would they would say we're alike and the other would say we're nothing alike. But the reason they say that we're alike is people think, and often we used to say that it was an argument between apples and oranges. That's not really true. The character that says we are nothing alike says we're apples and oranges.
Okay.
And the other character says, no, we're completely alike. We're both fruit. You see, the thing is, it's not 180 degrees diametrically opposed. The main and the influence character are not diametrically opposed. The protagonist and the antagonist are. That's where the diametrically opposed are. The main and the influence are 90 degrees to each other. One will see them as 90 degrees, the other see them as 270. Okay. Apart. The 90 degree one says, well, we're not so very different. We're only 90 degrees apart. And it says, we're completely different. We're 270 degrees different. We're as far different as you can get without being completely different. Okay? So that notion of being the same or being different is the core of that argument. And they're both right, is that they are at the same time like Schrodinger's cat. They are simultaneously the same and different because it uses two different standards to measure those, but both standards are valid.
Mm-hmm.
And therein lies the beauty of it, is that the message of the story is both standards are valid, but in this particular situation, which is a subject matter thing, in this particular situation, only one of these holds the opportunity for a solution, for inner peace.
Okay.
So, I'm going to start publishing the slides.
There's
175
wow.
slides, some of them with up to 8 different elements in them, 16 in a few.
Oh, excellent.
I'm going to publish those. I'm still trying to figure out a way to make money out of them. But I'm going to start publishing those on the internet. However, this whole notion about being alike and being different, I began to sense a resonance in the force of Dramatica structurally. And I realized that touches on so many points. For example, when you're looking at are we united or are we states, the answer is yes and yes. And it's because it's that same issue. Are we the same or are we different? And if you're saying we're the same, then we are the United States. It is the United States, and if we're different, we are the United States, each of us with a different identity.
Okay.
Which then carries us back to the idea of the companion-dependent dynamic and associative pairs, in which case we look at the example with the younger brother and the bigger brother, and we talk about there being either four component pieces in a quad, or it's one family. And so as long as we're looking at the independent individuals, big brother, little brother, they're always going to be in conflict because they're trying to find their individual identity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Whereas the family unit, if it's threatened from the outside, seizes up and becomes a family and tightens in, much like political parties are doing today. You're on the outside, you're on the inside. Okay. And so the whole core of the emotional argument between the main influence is actually reflected throughout the structure, everywhere we look, in terms of the dynamics of a story form, insofar as it's really about, are we family or are we independent? Are we the same or are we different? The answer is always yes for both. Mm-hmm. Each is equally true, except in context. And in the context of this particular subject matter, the writer is essentially saying, I have experience with this particular subject matter, and this subject matter used this way of looking at it, not that way.
Okay.
Which is really what the whole message of the story is about.
Okay, okay.
Now, you carry that all the way through the structure, and you'll find it repeated over and over again in so many places, more than I would want to get into today. But if you go all the way down to the equation level of grammatica and look at the K over T equals A D or T over K, the left side, I mean, when I originally woke up with that equation in my head, it was a verbal equation. It said one side divides and the other multiplies. That's how I saw it. So I wrote it that way with the four elements of the mind that we'd already come up with in terms of knowledge being the mass of the mind, thought being energy, ability being the space of the mind, and desire being time. Because after all, desire is based on the way things were compared to the way things are compared to the way they might be. That is the time sense of the mind, and only by using time can you determine whether or not you're happy with the way things are.
Because,
you know, they've been better or they've been worse, things are getting better, or they could be better than they are even though things are good, you know, that's it. So, I put it down originally as thinking it was a math equation, and it turns out that if you use it as a math equation, it can be converted to equals mc squared, for example. You take t over k equals a d, and you multiply both sides by k, and you end up k equals t a d, which is t equals KAD, which is E equals MC squared equivalent. But there's lots of other equations, some of which you'd have to be outside the universe to use if you converted them to physics. Because we can be outside our mind. Unlike the universe where we're stuck inside, we're all stuck inside. We're all part of that universe. You look at somebody else and you're outside their universe of mind. And so you can use equations to deal with other people that you could never conceive of using within yourself and would make no sense to look at from inside.
Okay.
So, that's part of the quad system. There's always that fourth place you can't quite get to, and that is where those external equations exist in Dramatica. Unfortunately, they provide them to us, but we can get a sense of it because of the fact we form a group mind, and when we form a group mind, so we talked about that everybody self-organizes into the voice of reason and a skeptic, which became the archetypes, that when we're in the group mind, we can actually look at that mind and say, this is the way that mind is functioning, and get an understanding about what's going on in our own head. So there is a way of associating dynamic systems on the outside and saying that's also what's going on the inside. However, the whole notion of you and I are both alike, and one side divides and the other multiplies. The dividing we originally looked at as logic, deduction, induction, knowledge parsed by thought, parsed by logic, against desirability. And we always began to read the equal sign as balanced against instead of equals. So this is the evolution of how we got there. As we said, that when you're keeping knowledge and thought separate, when you're looking at them as discrete, when you're playing them against each other, one side divided by the other, okay, then that is balanced against the other side combined, which is desirability, desire times ability. If ability is zero, even if desire is high, desirability is zero. If ability is zero, if desire is zero, even if ability is high, desirability is zero. So either way, you have to have a more than zero value of ability and desire in order to get a rating of desirability. And if you do, that desirability. So at first we read it where we said, when you're using logic on this side, it's balanced against your emotions. And
okay,
you
great.
Say, which one makes the most sense? Well, that sort of does the job, but it's not really what's going on in one's head. It may be the effect of what's going on is that you're balancing what you desire and feel able to do as a blended desirability. You're balancing desirability against what makes sense, okay? But it's more than that, because desirability is not just, it's not really balanced against it. It's, you have logic within you, you have reason, it's innate, to look at things discrete and compare them and arrange them to take thought and use knowledge to build it like bricks into a system of understanding, or to take knowledge and through a lot of thinking create a piece of knowledge, or from a single piece of knowledge generate a lot of thought, like E equals MC squared or in your mind. But the desirability side, at one level, though, it tells you, is this something I'm comfortable with versus what sense it makes. It also determines where you use your logic. People often say, no, I know my logic is sound, totally sound. Yes, your logic is totally sound. Why did you use it for this subject instead of using your logic on some other subject? That's desirability. So effectively, it directs where you're going to target your logic. So that's an extra level, as desirability determines where logic will be applied and where it won't be applied. And that's beginning to smack of the same thing with subject matter and with structure being tied together in a dumbbell and coming through that membrane psychologically, is because you're actually saying, well, I'm not going to use my logic here because I don't like the subject, okay? Now, doesn't that sound like Washington today? Okay. And so it's going on in a group mind, it's going on in the minds of our leaders, it's going on in the minds of the American people. Going on globally is, I won't even use my logic there. I'll just go with my feelings. And that is a reflection down to the basis of the structure where we say, if you're always using logic and it's not working, then you might say, I'll try feelings, which is the opposite, and you backburner logic, and that's how we get the flips and rotates. So it reflects, it resonates through all of these dynamics, even down into the equation. But that's not the end of it. Now, pregnant and plausible, I have another bite of
okay.
Stop.
Make sure it's still going. Still going.
Okay. Now, the other part about the equation that gets back to our influence in main characters, and the big brother and the little brother, and whether it's a family or not a family. I'm going to bring that a little closer.
It's good?
Okay.
It's good.
So, the tie-in is that one side divides, the other multiplies. One side is discrete, the other side directs it. But when, another way of looking at the equation is, when you see one side as being separate, the other side is blended.
Okay.
Separate, we're nothing alike. Blended, we're the same. And so that represents the two points of view of the main and the influence character is down to the basic equation, in which you say, whenever we put a box around something and define it and say, this is what's inside the box and this is what's outside the box, when we compartmentalize like that, and say, inside and outside, part of the family, not part of the family. That's the left side of the equation. That's the T over K. That's the discrete side, the side that defines. You're part of us, you're not part of us. The other side is blended and says, this is what we have in common. This is blended. This is where we are the same. And it creates a blending and says we're all part of the same family. We're all part of the same purpose. We all have the same desires or whatever. So, now we've gone from this simple theory point about the main and the influence characters and carried it all the way down to the equation and said that it's just another resonance from that equation.
Okay.
In fact, you will find that that is the elemental dynamic of Dramatica, is that there are always two equally accurate views, one of which says these things are independent, and the other view that says these things are part of the same thing. Not a yardstick, nothing like that, just that these are the same thing. And each one has truth because there are parts that are not the same and there are parts that are the same. So fluorine and chlorine are not the same, but they are the same because they're part of the same family in the periodic table. They're the same. But are they identical? Well, they're not identical, and that makes them different.
Okay.
And so those things are always true. Now, here's the big wraparound for me, is as the story goes, when I was around 5 years old, before I started kindergarten, back at the house that we're about a block from right now, when I was swinging on my swing set and saw a totally gray sky, I couldn't see anything but gray, and I thought to myself, if there was nothing, I mean, why is a kid thinking this was 5 years old? I mean, it was probably cursed. Somebody from outside the universe just said, spite you, you know, because instead of having fun all my life, I pursued this. God damn it. Anyway, so the thing is, I could see all gray, and I said, if there was nothing, I wonder if it would be all gray because there wasn't, I wonder if it would be black because there was no light, or if it was gray because there was also no dark, you know? And that was my question. And that didn't bug me so much, but what bugged me was that I could see that under one way of looking at it, one was true, the other way of looking at it, the other was true. And in those days, my parents had raised me to have a faith in God, so I said, well, if God is God, then he must be able to see the real truth, not these two incomplete truths that I'm seeing. I can only see that it could be one or the other. He must have a view in which he can see the real truth, in which they aren't conflicting, they aren't contradictory. That was okay. I can understand God was that powerful. But then I said, why did God build me with a brain that made it impossible for me to see that view? Mm-hmm. In five-year-old terms. How am I deficient that I'm unable to see the real truth that would make that it would be black and that it would be gray at the same time? And that's the core of the equation of mental relativity. That is the notion that we are incapable by nature because we are using four dimensions and you can only think about that and see, like they talk about the two-dimensional man on a piece of paper who's blocked by a line that you've put across it with a pencil. Mm-hmm. But you could lift the man up and carry him over that line and put him down on the other side because you've got an extra dimension. And what seems to him to be impossible or contradictory is only because he doesn't have another dimension of view that you've got. So they often talk about that a fifth-dimensional doctor could perform surgery without breaking the skin by reaching directly into you without going through the outside skin and performing surgery. Mm-hmm. And you can think of that conceptually, but you can't imagine it in reality because it's impossible, it's contradictory, even though you understand the concept. It would appear to be magic. Well, so that equation that I ultimately came to so many years ago is just a repeat of that same thing. It says, in a four-dimensional universe in which we are confined to thinking with four dimensions, it's impossible for us to ever resolve that. We cannot resolve it. And if you want to find inner peace, you better stop freaking trying. So the thing is that all world conflict and all inner conflict comes from the belief that there is a single solution. And that is the biggest misunderstanding that the human species has ever come to. There is no single solution. There's only contextual solutions.
Okay.
And just because somebody sees it completely opposite to you doesn't mean that... And you have all kinds of supporting experience and evidence and logic to support you, doesn't mean that your way of looking at it is any more true than theirs.
Okay.
Now, they may be wrong, and you may be able to prove them logically wrong, and they may agree. But when it comes down to it, no matter what you think, there's always another side to it that is contradictory and equally true. So it's not two sides of the same coin. That would be duality, where you have to look at it from this side, you have to look at it from that side.
How are you doing?
Very good, thank you.
Excellent.
Do you want me to take that, or are you all done?
Yeah, I am.
Perfect. Do you want a box? Or you still want
I would like a box shirt.
No, you got it. Sure.
Thank you.
So, the thing is that as long as we persist in saying that independent of context there is a right and a wrong, a good and an evil,
mm-hmm.
A correct and incorrect, independent of context, we've got it wrong. Eastern philosophies say, thank you.
You're welcome.
The Tao that can be spoken is not the total Tao. Because you can only grok the Tao. You can't actually say it. The minute you try to explain it, you've missed the point.
Mm-hmm.
And so I finally found somewhere between Heisenberg and Schrodinger, I found my piece, which was that I had to accept that the only reason I'm self-aware is because there's no single solution. If there was a single solution, a single answer, a single way of looking at things that would explain both the logical and the emotional, both the discrete and the blended view at the same time in the same space. If there was, there would be no self-awareness. It's the differential between those two views existing within us that creates the dissonance that is self-awareness. And so, stories structurally provide the framework by which we consider this differential. And subject matter provides the specifics by which we say this in this context go with this side of the differential, in that context go with that side.
Okay.
But it's only contextually that one is better than the other. In actuality of structure, independent of subject matter, that can never be resolved. And whenever we think it can, we believe we've got the answer.
Mm-hmm.
This leads to all of the conflict in the world. Anyway, so there's kind of a little overview of some of the stuff I'm working with.
So as you can see, it's like it's really great. It's such a simple thing. You know, one side sees things as discrete elements or separate parts, and the other side sees things as blended. And in some contexts, those things are, one side is correct or right, and in other contexts, the other side is right. And there is no one right answer, and that's why you have stories to say, oh, well, in this context, this is the right answer, and in this context, this is the right answer. And, you know, if people just understood that, there would be less problems in the world. So, yes, story can actually save the world, and Melanie's new path for Dramatica will certainly help make that a reality. Finally, I finally finished the whole series on plotting your story with Dramatica. Although now that I say that, I just realized I was going to go down to the sequence level and then the scene level, so maybe I didn't stop the series. Oy, oy, oy. All right, well, maybe I'll pick up the series another time. I wanted to, like, take a break from having to do an article, and instead of doing an article that feels right at the time. So what I did is I wrapped up the whole series with a look at generating dramatic tension within a four-act structure, which I realized is an infantile way of looking at story. But, you know, I can't help it. You know, I do what I can to try and help out. And, you know, if it's infantile, it's infantile. There's really not much I can do about that. So if you look at, let's see, let me bring it up here. So if you look at this week's article on generating dramatic tension within your story, this is part 5, you'll see that I go through the 4-act structures. So in prior articles in the series, I looked at 2-act structures and 3-act structures, and looked at how to use the story prerequisites and the story requirements, which are essential static plot points within a Dramatica story form, and using that to kind of determine the subjective tension within a story, which is great, right? And, you know, had some great examples and great fun with it and a lot of really positive feedback on it. So when it came to the 4-act structure, you know, I think I was putting it off because I wasn't really quite sure. You know, in the 3-act structure, I moved the prerequisites into the first act, the requirements in the second act, and the consequence in the third act. So when it came to the 4 acts, it's like, well, okay, do I move them all back and then somehow the goal comes up at the end, or is the goal at the beginning? And I was going to manufacture something that I thought would make sense, until the combination of taking the break, thinking of things more fractally, and then, of course, my conversation with Melanie last week about discrete and blended and how both are appropriate in different contexts. And then it just made sense to me that, you know, you have prerequisites and requirements in the story as a whole, and then as you go down into different dramatic units, you know, fractal units, which would be the acts, and then the sequences, and the scenes, and the beats, that relationship between prerequisites and requirements leading up to the goal, motivated by the consequence, all those work together, you know, and then like a little quad that can be repeated everywhere. So prerequisites and requirements, you can use them, you know, in a 4-act structure. It alternates. It walks around the quad in such a way that you'll first deal with some discrete conflict and then some blended conflict and some discrete conflict and then some blended conflict. So you know, in one you would do prerequisites in the first and requirements in the second, and then prerequisites in the third and requirements in the fourth. So you're essentially repeating the same pattern in different contexts as you work your way down fractally through the model, which I believe is, it's a more holistic way of looking at the relationship between the static plot points rather than the linear progression of those static plot points. So it's not so much this leads to that, this leads to that, and then da-da, we're done. It's like, well, this is relating to this on the way to this other place, and it slows it down, it speeds it up, it increases the rate at which we see things, and it increases or decreases the rate at which things are increasing, and vice versa, and back and forth, all this dynamic stuff. It's more about the relationship between those static plot points that is important, not so much the actual progression in the order that they go in. And I'm sure that it gets repeated into sequences. I know that it gets repeated into scenes so that, you know, you can set up an actual, like, prerequisite and requirement relationship within the actual scene itself, when you want the characters interacting with each other as they move towards their way to either fulfilling a prerequisite in the in that particular sequence or in that act as their way to fulfill the requirement that they need in the second act. Like, all that stuff, if you stop trying to find, like, a particular way of using it and just see, like, well, this is a really beneficial way to me that I can get to my story quick and confidently and keep it all thematically on track, and think of every unit as the same thing, just at different sizes, I think that's a more sophisticated way of seeing how narrative works together. So that you have the story as a whole, and then within that story are little tinier stories, which are the acts, and then that are little tinier stories, which are the sequences, and little tinier stories, and then beats. And then by the time you get to the beats, it actually loops back onto itself, where you're back to seeing it as the piece of a larger story, and you can't really get smaller than that. I feel like that's a really great, sophisticated way of looking at story. And it was interesting because when I was trying to find examples for four-act structures, all of them were novels. I mean, we had To Kill a Mockingbird, The Godfather, Great Gatsby, and the one I went with was Pride and Prejudice. Like, they're all based, obviously they have film adaptations, but they're all based on novels. And I think the screen real estate or the page real estate within a novel makes it easier to be able to explore story points in a holistic, relationship-based manner. You know, in a film, a two-hour film, it's like, I don't have time to relate everything in a way that doesn't take time into account, whereas a novel can be as long or as short as you want it to be, and it's not so much the time that's there, it's the relationship between the items within the novel that is important and is part of the experience of the reader or the audience. And so I feel like that's a great way. It's like, you know, novels are structured the same way as story or as film is structured the same way as plays, but the medium itself lends itself to a particular narrative because of the focus on the more relationship-based thematics within that particular story form or that narrative. And I just found that really compelling, really interesting, because I've never thought of that before. So if you have a chance, make sure you check that out. I'll link to it in the show notes. I got to clean it up and recheck it and make sure all the spelling is right before somebody sends me an email explaining it to me. And you know, then we'll move on to some other things. Like I said, I was going to go look at the sequences and see how that plays out with the static plot points and, of course, the scenes, and just continue to build up this understanding of a practical application of a way to use Dramatica to tell greater and infinitely more compelling stories. So that's it for this week's podcast. If you have any questions, please write to us at narrativefirst.com/contact. If you're interested in learning more about the Dramatica Mentorship Program, of course, contact us there. We'd love to get you set up. Have a great week of writing, and we will see you next time.